On this episode of On the Clock with Kristen Peek, we are joined by Adam Finkelstein, director of scouting at 247 Sports and college basketball insider at CBS. We run through the NBA draft withdrawal deadline, talk about all the players that are staying in this draft and going back to school, and a little bit of draft talk as to who's going to take what player inside the lottery. Welcome to On the Clock with Kristen Peek. I'm Kristen Peek, NBA draft analyst for Yahoo Sports. We'll be coming to you each week between the NBA draft lottery and the NBA draft itself with everything you need to know about this year's upcoming class. Today, we're joined by one of my favorite people that I ever see in the gym, Adam Finkelstein. He's the director of scouting at 247 Sports and a college basketball insider at CBS. Adam, I know I said this last week, but I say it every time I have somebody who's like in the basketball business. I can't believe we're both home, one. And two, like, thank you so much for making the time. I know we're both super busy right now.
No, happy to do it. Happy to do it. I'm always here. Always happy to hear your overly optimistic takes and then balance it out with some pessimism. So let's do this.
So last year, Adam was on the pod and, you know, he always says like that. You just said, I'm always very optimistic. You see me in the gym. I tend to have more positive things to say about players than you do. So like I have like the sweet take. Yes. Yes. You are like the salty take. And I love that. I love always bouncing different names off of you and having that discussion. But today, you know, I'm sure I like to say this draft class is half glass full. Last week we had Rob Cassidy from Rivals.com. Last week, Rob said, let's call it what it is. This draft class is weak. It's not good. We're seeing it take shape a little bit more with the NBA withdrawal deadline happening Wednesday night at 11:59 Eastern. What were the biggest surprises for you from seeing who's staying in and who's returning?
I was surprised that Hunter Salas went back to Wake. When he opted out of playing at the NBA draft combine, I really thought that was an indication that he wasn't, you know, he was looking to protect his stock, not really gauge where it was. So that was a big one for me. I think Alex Caravan certainly was as important of a decision as there was in terms of the impact it'll have on college basketball next year, going back to the two-time defending champions, UConn. And then I think that Christie, you know, like there is Cam Christie is someone who I honestly wasn't surprised. I don't want to say like, oh, I knew it was happening the whole time. But there was a lot of buzz that he was trying to stay in this draft. I think there was a perception among many that maybe he had a robust NIL market. Maybe his stock could have really jumped up a year from now. I think all of that is true. But given the way his older brother Max handled the process and how it's worked out for him, really. And some of the momentum and just kind of behind the scenes buzz that I heard about Cam at the combine, I'm not surprised he stayed in, but he was certainly one of the more polarizing decisions.
Okay. Cam Christie, I want to get into a little bit later, but UConn reloading, they have to be, I feel like UConn and probably Wake Forest have to be two of the big, and Alabama. We didn't even talk about Alabama with Jaren Stevenson and also Mark Sears coming back. So UConn and Alabama have to be the biggest winners from the withdrawal deadline. Are those two teams, both UConn and Alabama, are they favored, do you think, next year to make a Final Four run because of what they have returning?
I think given what UConn has done the last 2 years, they're going to be favored until somebody proves otherwise. But like, listen, they're losing a lot. Caravan going back means they have one starter going back. Now, they retain the vast majority of their second unit, but a lot of times they only played six or seven guys in that Final Four run. So they made some huge additions, obviously getting Liam McNeely, a top 10 prospect in the class, to commit late, getting Terrace Reed out of the transfer portal, getting Aiden Mahaney out of the transfer portal. But this is, you know, I think people are just taking for granted that like, oh yeah, of course they're going to go back to the Final Four. They're going to contend for a repeat. Like that's a lot harder than it is to just say, and it's for good reason that we are giving them the benefit of the doubt because Danny Hurley and his staff have just been coaching wizards, quite frankly, over the last 2 years. I mean, what they've been able to do, I just like to say like they're playing chess when everybody else is playing checkers, and The best example I will give you of that, just quick side point here, is like, how many college basketball games have you and I watched, KP? And usually, like, when your team is in a big moment, the best coaches, they put their best players in positions to make a play. Like, that's good coaching. You know who your best player is. You get them the ball in his spots, and you try and manipulate the defense to give them the best opportunity to make a play. Well, Dan Hurley doesn't do that. He just figures out what the defense is doing. He figures out their actions, and they run something to get a layup. And I mean like a layup. And it happened time and time again down this national championship stretch. It happened in the national championship game itself more than one occasion. And so it's just why I say, like, they're playing chess and everybody else is playing checkers. So yeah, they're going to be favored until somebody proves otherwise.
This is completely off topic, but we look at Cooper Flagg next year and he's going to Duke, but the other school in the running was UConn. One of his best friends, Liam McNeely, his teammate from Mount Verde, obviously committed there. Do you think there's going to be any sort of like commitment remorse or regret when the season hits? Or do you think
who knows what he's thinking? Yeah, who knows what he's thinking behind the scenes? I mean, I thought it was interesting that you know, Hurley basically put it out there of like, hey, we'll, like, kind of alluding to Duke, like, hey, we'll play anybody, anywhere, anytime. Like, we went to Kansas, like, we'll play Duke. I'm more interested to see if there's any legs for that matchup. I would suspect there's not. Duke already announced their schedule, but UConn was really, really close in that recruitment. In fact, I think it's fair to say they led at one point after their visit. You know, Cooper Flagg's mom played with Donovan Klingon's mom at Maine, and they really did a good job of you know, utilizing that storyline and tapping into the emotional connection of that. And obviously, I think there was a lot of belief in Hurley and in Luke Murray. But, you know, Duke, I mean, it's hard to beat Duke. You get the kid on campus for Midnight Madness or their version of it, and everybody's chanting his name. So I don't know if there's going to be buyer's remorse. It probably is going to have a lot to do with how the season goes. You know, if UConn gets back to the Final Four and Duke doesn't, then maybe at that point. But, you know, you don't hear too many people who go to Duke and then say, like, you know, I had a bad year, especially who are as celebrated as somebody like Cooper is. But listen, UConn's just, I mean, it's not biased to say, like, UConn is just on another level right now.
They are, fair to say, like, the most dominant program, I think, in the last, I don't know, would you say 5 years? Are they a blue blood now? Do you think UConn has earned the
I think
term
all
of blue
that
blood?
Like, listen, here's what I know. They've won more national championships in the last, what is it, like 25 years than anyone or whatever. Like, the blue blood stuff, that's just talking head narrative, which I get I am at this point, but like their recent history of success is better than anyone. So call them what you want. You know, like, here, I live in Connecticut and everything's like the basketball capital, the college basketball capital of America. So like, everybody's going to have their narratives, but they've been better than anybody over an extended period of time. What that equates to, blue blood or whatever, new blood, who cares? They've just been better than anyone, and especially in the last 2 years.
Alex Caravan returning, probably the biggest name. I talked to a few teams yesterday, and they were happy about it. I mean, he was one of the best shooters on the court. He played very well in the 5-on-5. We were there. We saw it. He won the 3-point star shooting drill. I think he is, you know, a first round favor for next year. So very happy to see Alex Caravan go back, probably get some, you know, NIL money and lead this UConn team. We mentioned Cam Christie, and people listening to the pod are probably like, who exactly? His older brother is Max Christie. He was drafted by the Los Angeles Lakers in 2022 in the second round. Cam is a freshman at Minnesota, 6'6". Guard, wing, perimeter player, only averaged 11 points, 3 rebounds, 2 assists this year, but also shot the ball 40% from 3. And I think when NBA teams and scouts are looking back at film and seeing how the teams left in the NBA playoffs and what they have, we're looking at Minnesota and Dallas and also the Boston Celtics and these long, versatile perimeter players that can shoot and put the ball on the ground. And Cam kind of has flashes of that. He, to me, is very intriguing and a name that is popping up late first round, early second round. He didn't do very well at the combine. He kind of disappeared, but apparently he's having very, very good, consistent workouts. And so I'm not that surprised that he's staying in the draft. But also, this happens every year, Fink. Like, what is it about this kid, do you think, that translates to the NBA game? And do you think, like you said, like, I'm not surprised that he's staying in the draft. Do you think he already has a promise?
So I think the goal has been to secure a promise for quite some time. And even in the weeks leading up to the combine, that was the narrative. I mean, when you talk to people around this situation, you'd hear like, yeah, they're trying to get him a promise. They're trying to get him a promise. And that was the talking point about it. I think even at the combine itself, talking to the NBA scouts, people were really intrigued with him. And that's what's really interesting to me about Cam Christie is the disconnect between kind of the NBA people and then some of the college basketball people. I had one prominent Big Ten coach call me and was like, can you explain this to me? Like, we didn't have any problems guarding this guy. We shut him down. Now you're telling me he's a first round pick. And it's really about the disconnect between what he is right now in a college game versus what he could be down the road in an NBA game, because those two games are very different. He's got the positional size. He's got the shooting. The lack of physicality can be glaring at the college level, but I think there's optimism long term that in an NBA weight room with an NBA strength and conditioning program, that's going to evolve. And so long term, you see an opportunity to get an asset that, you know, if you're in the back end of the first round or if you're in the early second round, you're thinking to yourself, you know what, if this guy goes back to school, we're probably not in a position to draft him a year from now. Because it's very possible he's at the front end of the top half of the first round. And I think that's something that people don't talk about enough. I remember hearing this story about Donovan Mitchell, like the teams who tried to get him to come out a year before he did out of Louisville because they knew they weren't going to be able to get him a year from now. And so they recognized it for an NBA scout. They don't care. Like, the decision-making process isn't, is this guy NBA ready? It's, hey, maybe we can get him now when we won't be able to a year from now. That was definitely the context around the Donovan Mitchell discussion. Of course, he decided to go back to Louisville, ended up being drafted, I think it was late lottery. And I'm not saying Cam Christie would have followed that exact path, but I do think there are teams, whether they're in the late first round or early second, who are very happy to see him stay in here because they see him as a long-term stock and not a guy who's going to come in and be able to immediately impact an NBA game.
Funny story about Donovan Mitchell. The year he was drafted, Markelle Fultz was the number one pick. Donovan went to his autograph signing 2 days before. You know, these guys show up to New York a couple days early. And Donovan went to, I think it was Foot Locker, waited in line and then pranked Markelle and was like, oh, can I have your autograph? Can I have your autograph? I'll never forget that because I was obviously there.
Did Markelle get Donovan's autograph? Because yes. One might be worth more than the other. I'm just saying.
Oh, fake. Amazing. This is why, you know, I'm sweet. You're salty.
Sweet and salty.
Yes. All right. Another name. I want to touch on a couple losers from the withdrawal.
Right in my alley. Yeah.
Deadline. Coleman Hawkins, the 6'10 forward, swing four, whatever you want to call him, elected to return, but he's not returning to Illinois. And he told reporters at the draft combine that he will never play in the Big Ten again. He's not going to play in the Big East. He wants to go to a school where they have football culture. So that sounds like the SEC or Big 12 to me. But I just can't believe that he's prioritizing, you know, football tailgating as opposed to returning and playing and helping his draft stock next year. How much of this is a loss for Illinois? I know they have a couple international guys coming in. And where do you think, who's the early favorite to land Coleman Hawkins for his fifth year?
Well, I don't think Illinois was ever operating under the premise that they were getting Coleman Hawkins back. So I think it's disappointing to see that he's not going to spend his last year of college basketball in their jersey. But from a planning perspective, I think they were always expecting to move on after this season. As for Coleman Hawkins and some of his sound bites, it's like, come on, man. And you know, we saw this at the combine, you more than me, because these kids are especially open with you. But it's like, really? Is that really what you want to say? When I talk to kids in high school, I will sometimes say to them, I'll be like, are you sure you want to say that? Like, you know, because they're kids. Now, by the time you get to the combine, like, come on, you gotta do a little bit better than that. Like, I want to go to the football game. Now, listen, I suspect what he might be saying is or alluding to is the fact that the NIL payday could be higher at schools that have a big football commitment. Obviously, I think there's a correlation there. And so I think certainly that's something to keep an eye on, because I don't think Coleman Hawkins is coming back to college basketball for a mediocre payday, given the way that we've seen the NIL market evolve in the last 3 or 4 weeks here, and the amount of big time programs that still need an impact player in the paint. I think Coleman Hawkins is going to command a significant NIL deal. And that to me is the way I translate that comment, is like, hey, I'm coming back to play for a school that has a robust commitment to athletics across the board and can afford to pay me top dollar. That was my, it's no inside information. That's just my interpretation of that comment.
You want to give a hot take as to where you think he's going to go?
No, I don't.
All right.
You?
I have no idea. Like, I haven't been following the Coleman Hawkins portal. Yeah. I mean, I'll make a couple calls. You and I both will. We'll call some coaches. We'll figure it out. But at this moment, no. The day after the deadline, no. Okay, players that elected to stay in the draft. Shock to nobody, Bronny James is keeping his name in the draft. I thought we already knew this. I didn't know this was breaking news yesterday when Woj wrote the story.
I think we've known this for 3 years, but yes. When you're only saying the things that are obvious, it's you know, I mean, you're in the minority, I guess, but you know, whatever.
I mean, it's funny, before we even started the pod this year for On the Clock, I said, Fink, can you come on again? These are the topics we're going to discuss. Obviously, Bronny, we're going to deep dive into him. And you're like, I've already said everything I want to say about Bronny James.
My position hasn't changed in the last year. I've said everything, you know, like I really haven't. I think he's going to be on the Lakers. I said it a year ago. I still think he's going to be on the Lakers. Now, obviously, some things have really changed in terms of like his health, you know, with that traumatic health scare over the summer. And I've said this, I think we should be talking more about that. Like what a, you know, what are the ramifications of that? All credit to him to getting back on the court, to being able to play through that type of trauma. But in terms of his basketball destination, like, listen, LeBron James, when he says things repeatedly, it's usually for a reason. And he said repeatedly that he wanted to play with his son. He said it repeatedly. Then he said that Bronny could help them right now. Now, granted, the goalpost has moved a little bit with some of the public comments in the last weeks and months. But this is arguably the most influential player in NBA history when it comes to dictating front office maneuvers. And when he tells you time and time again that he wants to play with his son, and by the way, he can be a free agent this year, so in case he didn't have enough leverage already, he's got even more. Oh, and by the way, he's like the Tom Brady of basketball and just doesn't age. So he's far from on his last leg. And now it looks like he's going to command another multi-million dollar deal and still be one of the best players in the NBA. So like, if you're the Lakers, why wouldn't you? Like, okay, we'll throw in a, think about how common it is for late second round picks to be thrown into transactions. You're telling me they're not going to take Bronny when that's what LeBron wants? I don't understand, and I have never understood, like, why this is a mystery. Like, LeBron has said it time and time again. And then, and you can probably elaborate on this better than I can, but everything in the last couple of weeks has only supported that conclusion. He doesn't want a two-way, okay? He's not going to sign a two-way. Guaranteed money only. Like, okay, so that's going to deter anybody else from taking him. There's 10 teams that want to work him out, but he's only working out for two, the Lakers and the Suns. So nobody else has a chance to see him. Like, he's going to be on the Lakers. Yes, I don't really have anything new to say, because that's what I've been saying for the last year.
Listen, this isn't rocket science, people. Connect the dots. LeBron James and Bronny James are both going to be in Laker yellow next year. It just depends. Coached by J.J. Redick. It just depends on where he's going to get drafted. I don't think he's going to be there at 55. I think teams are too smart to allow that to happen for him just to fall.
Really?
Especially, yes, I think there's going to be teams that are going to call Rich Paul and they're going to say, look, I know Bronny didn't come in. We're going to take him at 32. We're going to take him at 40. We're, you know what I mean?
Well, and I don't, here's what I think will happen in that situation. And this is interesting, because I think what will then happen is they will be told, don't do that. You know, just like Austin Reeves. How did Austin Reeves get with the Lakers in the first place? Somebody was going to take him in the second round. He said, please don't take me. That happens in the draft, especially in the second round. And Clutch is a huge agency. So if somebody's going to take him early, if we're going to assume that Clutch is going to tell people, don't take him, and that is consistent with what we've seen. He's only working out for two teams. So I'm just going off what they've said publicly. He's only working out for the Lakers and the Suns. So unless it's the Suns, I'm assuming that they're going to say, do not draft Bronny. We're then going to assume that they're going to say, no, Rich Paul, no, Clutch, you don't have enough juice. I'm going to do it anyway. Like, I don't think that's worth it. I just don't think the risk reward ratio is makes sense for an NBA team at that point. But that's just me.
I mean, you make a very good point. We still have an entire month to talk about Bronny. So thank you for giving your two cents on him. You and I think, like, I think back to the first time I ever saw Bronny play. It was his eighth grade going into ninth grade year. Like, this isn't just nothing new that we've seen. You and I have been in the gym with him for the last 5 years. We've seen him grow as a player. We've seen how, I think, well he's conducted himself going through this entire process. And you cannot take that away from him. And the fact that at every single road, every single crossroad, he's definitely performed under pressure. At McDonald's All-American, he was 5-for-8 from three when everyone said he's only there because of who his dad is. At Hoop Summit, he had the game-winning block to beat Team World. And then at the Combine, he, you know, was second in the three-point star shooting drill, was the leading scorer in the second game for the Combine. So he can play and he delivers. He is a prospect. He's going to get drafted. And he's going to be on the Lakers next year. And everybody can see the first father-son duo in history. That's it. That's all I want to say about Bronny moving forward. Another name that was shot lights out, Johnny Furphy. He turned down this is what I've heard from NBA teams. He turned out a huge NIL deal to return to Kansas and is electing to stay in this year's draft. And he should. In this draft class where it's weaker, and I think he's a first round lock. You know, he's far from a polished project product, but there's a lot of upside to him. Were you surprised at all that he decided to stay in?
No, I wasn't. I mean, I think behind the scenes there was some momentum and certainly some efforts to keep him in Lawrence, especially when, like, you know, they've got wings coming in. But again, depth looks like it could be an issue in Lawrence next year. So I think there was a significant push to try and keep him. But I mean, this is a guy who a year ago, and very literally a year ago, he was expecting to go back to NBA Academy and put himself basically do his senior year of high school over again and not even come into college until September of 2024. So he was going to be, you know, he wasn't even going to be in college this year. So he made that late commitment after playing in the summer with NBA Academy. And then he started the season on the bench. Then he jumped in mid-year. And there's still some holes in his game. Like, I don't know that he's ready to impact the game defensively at an NBA level. But I really believe in late bloomers. And when you see someone who has gotten, who has improved as much as he has over the course of the last 16 months. I mean, KP, I'm telling you, I saw this guy live in January of 2023, and he was being talked about as a mid-major recruit. That's 17 months ago, and right now he's very likely a first-round pick. So that to me is just I put a lot of emphasis on kind of the arc of how they're going and the rate which they're improving, and he's improving at a rapid rate. And I get that he's a defensive liability right now, but the size, the shooting, the rate of improvement. Like, I like Johnny Furphy more than most, not as someone who's going to come in and make an impact next year, but as someone 5 years from now, you look back and you'll say, wow, they got him at 27. That was a good pick.
How much has NIL changed the landscape for the draft?
Ooh, I mean, significantly, right? I mean, that's even an understatement. I think that there was once a time where there were players who declared for the draft knowing that they weren't ready because they just had to. They had to be able to earn money to put, you know, to help their families. It wasn't just about them, whether they had, you know, parents, siblings, kids, whatever the case may be. I'm not going to say names, but I know that has been a talking point even in recent drafts. And the NIL market right now is so significant. It's hard to verify what these numbers are, whether they have contracts or not. Like, I think this Florida case is going to be very interesting and going to be an important precedent in terms of locking in these numbers. That's, of course, on the football side, but it's going to have ramifications in basketball. But the bottom line is that right now, these players who are on the bubble, if they view themselves as probable second round picks, the likely two way deals, that a two way deal is a non-guaranteed, which is the part nobody talks about, just over $500,000. I think the vast majority of these guys, I'm operating under the assumption that they are going to get a bigger dollar amount by going back to college, because I think that when you hear about some of these NIL numbers that are being tossed around, oftentimes they are higher than that for the highest level players. And make no mistake about it, the guys we're talking about who are going back to school right now, they are highest level players. So I think it's changed it dramatically. I think you would see 5 to 10 more players stay in this draft if it weren't for NIL that have now gone back to college. So I think it's a good thing because it helps college basketball. I think ultimately it helps these kids too, because they are in situations where they can stay and develop and not have to rush to the NBA. Because another thing that people don't talk about, KP, and you know this better than anyone, like, some of these G League teams are a mess. Like, you don't want to go hang out in these G League teams where you don't have the daily support that maybe you have in a college program. And I mean, like, away from the basketball, like learning how to be, a mature adult 24 hours a day. I mean, that's part of the process that I think is the NBA is still, and certainly it varies by franchise, still trying to figure out in a lot of these G League situations. So I think a lot of these kids are fortunately now, because of NIL, in a situation where they can go back to college, make more money than they otherwise would have, at least this year, and be in a spot where they can better develop and be prepared to handle the professional lifestyle whenever they get there.
Yes. Very well said, Fink. Always, always an expert on...
There's no counterpoint here.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back with more insights on the current and future NBA draft classes. Welcome back to On the Clock with Kristen Peek. I'm joined by Adam Finkelstein with 247 Sports and CBS. We're talking about this year's draft class. And Fink, we're going to do something that I like to call make the pick. I like to end every episode with this. If you are the Atlanta Hawks, the first trade. Number one pick, trade the pick. If you are keeping the pick, who are you taking and why?
I am probably taking Zachary Risache, because now let me just say this. This is without the benefit of the level of due diligence that I'm sure they're doing, from the workouts, to the interviews, to the medical, to the personality testing, another thing we don't talk about that is done by most teams. I am skeptical of Alex Saar. I've talked about, and I don't mean to be critical, but just as a number one pick, when you're talking about a 7-footer who doesn't stretch the floor yet, who's not an extreme vertical athlete, at least among bodies right now. I mean, his upside is based on the defensive versatility, and certainly that is significant. But like, he doesn't shoot, not necessarily a vertical spacer right now, not necessarily a great rebounder. And he's kind of this narrow built five man. Like, I still think he's got an upside. I don't mean to just highlight the negatives, although that is my way. But like, I struggle with that at number one. Conversely, you've got Reese Hoshea, who's got this wing size, this shooting, who's starting to show some flashes of more dynamic athleticism. So I would probably go Reese Hoshea, but again, that is, you know, I think this is close enough where you've really got to dig into the minutiae if you're these teams and using all the resources that are at your disposal. And again, medical, personality testing, all that stuff that we can't really talk about as the media, but I think can sometimes be very important. Who are you taking?
I don't know. I, I, like, we don't have to make the pick. I wrote on Sar yesterday. I went back and watched a lot of his film. Obviously, I went to Australia. I saw him play the best team in the NBL, the Melbourne
Obviously
United.
Obviously, you went to Australia? Obviously, I went to Australia. KP goes everywhere.
Well, anytime somebody gives me an excuse to go to Australia, okay, twist my arm. I lived there for 2 years. I want to go back and see my mates and, like, you know, and watch some basketball. But this, I don't know. I'm with you. Like, it's, I'm just glad I'm not the Atlanta
Hawks. You're just too nice. You're just too nice to say you're not taking him at number one. This is amazing.
You are convincing me. And to his point, Zachary is playing some of his best basketball right now. The same thing happened with Bilal Coulibaly. He's playing over for JL Borg. They're in the playoffs. I don't think they're going to get past this round. They're playing the defending champions. But he is playing phenomenal. And talk about a time to be playing some of your best basketball right now. Like, he's making a strong case. I go back and forth every day. But the next team I want to ask you about, Spurs have two lottery picks, 4 and 8. They obviously need some playmakers to get Wimby more touches, the more ball. What do you think they do at 4 or 8?
So I think they need shooting. That to me is a priority. So I think both of the Kentucky guards are in play, not necessarily together, but like, does Reed Shepherd become someone who you like the defensive playmaking? You love the culture part of it. You like the shooting splits from last year. Don't look at his shooting numbers from high school because they're vastly different. You know, and then does, and if you don't take, you know, if you take somebody else at 4, does someone like, and let's assume Reed is off the board at 8. I know that's an assumption and far from a guarantee, but is Dillingham in play at 8? Does Shepherd slip to 8? So I think those are some of the more interesting ones. I think they would have loved to have been in a spot to get Reese Hoshea at 4. I don't know. Right now, it doesn't seem like he's going to be on the board there. But I would defer to your intel on this because people do like talking to you much more than they like talking to me. So what do you think San Antonio is going to do?
Reed is definitely in play for the Spurs. Okay. I also think Tijon Salon, who is another French wing at 8, is in play. He too ended the season playing some of his best basketball. They share the same agent. Him, Wembanyama, and Tijon share
scouts
the same
like
agent.
Him too.
Yes, scouts really like his upside. Again, like I think Reed and probably Tijon are in play there. I don't know about Rob. Like, everything I keep hearing about Rob coming in at 6'1", a buck 64. Didn't go through agility, didn't go through shooting, didn't go through his pro day. It feels like their clutch is hiding him a little bit to secure a draft stock, or he has a promise. But when you go back and look at the film, just defensively, it's who does he guard in the NBA? Do you know what I mean? And so I'm not very high on Rob. I know he's a dog. I know he proves people wrong. He'll probably prove me wrong his rookie year and go out and be awesome. But there's something going on there. The fact that he, as a competitor and has never had an injury before in his life, is kind of hiding a little bit. The last team I want to ask you about, Sam Presti, the GM for Oklahoma City Thunder, he addressed the media for 30 minutes. He talked about how he loves this draft class, and he made reference to there's always going to be guys. They just have to find them. And so what he loves most about his job, and to his credit, he totally backs this up, is he likes scouting. He likes being in the gym. I don't know any other GM that is at more high school events than Sam Presti. They have the 12th pick. Jalen Williams, who they took in the lottery a couple of years ago, his little brother, Cody Williams, who played 1 year at Colorado, might be there at 12. This is the same guy that drafted 2 Jalen Williams in the same draft. I mean, like, and he is just one of those guys for his team. You get 2 playmakers in Josh Giddey and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. You get a unicorn center like Chet, and then you just get 6'7" plus defensive machines and playmakers on the wings to kind of keep everyone guessing. Do you think Sam Presti will draft Cody Williams if he's there at 12?
I think it's very possible. I think they're going to have... I'm going to twist the question just a little bit, if you don't mind. I think it'll be very glaring if he's available and they don't, because we know that they are going to have better intel than anyone. And so if they don't take him, it would be pretty telling to me. Cody's one of the more high risk, high reward prospects in that this class. We've talked a lot throughout high school, even this year at Colorado, like the potential has always exceeded the production. Now, there were extenuating circumstances. He had some nagging injuries. He had to play with the mask this year, but there were times, especially in the NCAA tournament, where you just didn't know he was on the floor. But the narrative about Cody has always been he's farther along than Jalen is at the same stage. And at some point, like, I also wonder if it would be detrimental for Cody's development to be next to Big Brother, who's on his way to being a perennial all-star and constantly compared to him. I know that's been a thing in the NBA, like the Mobleys play together and stuff like that. But so I think it's very possible. But again, I think it's going to be telling because OKC is going to have great intel. And there is a part of me that thinks that Cody might be better off just in his own place, able to create his own identity.
See, you say that, but then when you talk to Cody himself, he wants to play with his brother. He said they grew up and it was always his brother, Jalen, was always older, too much older than him for them to play on the same team. So Jalen just said, oh, well, I guess we're both just going to have to make the NBA and we can hopefully play together. And it's so funny because Cody said to me, he's like, yeah, and my brother made the NBA and now I'm a year removed from possibly making the NBA. And, you know, it's not that hard. And I'm like, you can't say that. Like,
no, it's pretty hard.
Yeah. Yes, it's very hard. You guys are both just very good at basketball. Thank you for Adam for sharing his insights. You can follow him on Twitter at Adam Finkelstein. Follow me on Twitter too at Kristen Peak. Thanks to Brett and Joe behind the scenes for making everything happen. Jake Fisher and Dan Devine will be back Friday morning on this feed with a new episode of No Cap Room. Until next week, we are out. Thanks for listening.